had a pregnant Vietnamese lady, you know, she was about after by 8 long, just close to 9 months pregnant. Mm-hmm. And I actually seen her, you know, she was on a bridge with had 3 little kids on the side of her, and she, you know, she was suffering, you know. And they were taking these guys, these other Vietnamese in prison, you know, taking them to their captives and taking them to a POW camp. And she couldn't move, and what he did, man, he just took his hand and jammed it up her vagina, man, and squashed the baby head or whatever it was inside. He just pulled whatever was in there out of her, just like that, man. Yeah. You know, I mean, he actually did that, man. And, I mean, with, you know, I've seen it, we've seen it, you know what I mean? It was nothing we really could have done right about that stuff, man. You know, it would have been, wow.
What kind of a person was this staff sergeant? Did you know him at all?
Yeah. I mean, I knew his name and stuff like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he used to drink scotch every night, you know, and try to shoot this opium stuff into his van that they know of and stuff like that, you know.
Uh-huh.
That's how a lot of guys really got hung up in Vietnam off the hard drugs, stuff like that, you know, because there's so much you've seen happen over there, you know, and it's not... You know, it was a lot of people that should have died didn't, you know, a lot of people should have lived, you know, they didn't. And, man, you know, like just seeing somebody stick a hand up somebody's vagina and just pull a baby out and, you know, just cut their stomach with their knives and stuff like that, you know, it's really something else to see, you know. And, you know, give them poison and stuff like that, you know, see them dying. And, you know, like those soldiers there, they were very determined, you know, because I know we was out in the field, you know, in the Delta, and we were shooting 60 calibers that night, you know, and you can see traces passing all over this guy, all through this guy's body, you know, 60 calibers, and rounds are very, very big, you know. And he must have ran about 60 yards before he fell. He must have had over 100 rounds into his body, you know. He was trying to make it through where we were from the compound, you know, and just throw grenades and stuff. But he got back from here, he got about at least about 12 yards away from us. You know, he must have ran about 60 yards before he fell. So that's good. It was very determined, man, to win that walk. And you'd be out there, you know, on the fields and stuff like that. You see little guys, I mean, little children out there in the uniforms, man, you know, no older than 12 years old, little boys and little girls, you know what I mean, that your bullets or your bombs and stuff like that have destroyed these children and stuff like that. We never had a chance to really live. But they were determined to fight for their country. They died for us, you know what I mean? And I don't care that the United States would have stayed there 50 years, they wouldn't have won that war, man. Because, you know, these people
were determined.
Yeah, they were determined, you know. We threw away a pipe, you know, or anything. We couldn't throw anything away because whatever we threw away, they made weapons out of it, you know what I mean? So. I mean, you know, they know how to fight, and they fought the way they know how. That's what it was, you know. Because we had all these Cobras helicopters and stuff that shoot many guns and shoot rockets and stuff like that. And even I had these sensory devices mm-hmm. on there that could smell the odor of Vietnamese and stuff like that, you know, and the jungle and stuff like that. And we still couldn't win because I've seen many helicopters shot at the sky, and, you know, and, jets and stuff like that, you know, really shot down, and, you know, and really people really dying out there, man. You know, like I used to see on TV, wow, what a war story, you know, but once you actually get into it, you know, it's a different story, man. You know, the horror, the hollow of death and stuff like that, the suffering, the pain, the smell of the peculiar odor of death, you know, it's just, you know, it's really something else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, which I'm not glad that it happened nothing like that, but now I'm just glad that I had this experience. I experienced it myself, you know, and I know about it, you know, and nobody didn't have to come back and tell me about it, you know, what the white man would do to whoever it is, man. I think he'll do it to himself, you know what I mean, if it's necessary.
Really brutalized
man.
Wow. And when you came back to the United States and you were out of the army, did this kind of, like, affect you in any way and the whole experience?
Yeah, what it did, it sent my mom a paper saying, you know, if I hear a siren or something like that and I run for a gun or run outside and, you know, start shouting, you know, ambush or something like that, you know. don't pay no attention, just trying to hold me back.
Did you ever go through those?
I went through a lot of nightmares, you know, where I woke up shouting in the bed, sweating a lot. It took me a while to get rid of it, you know. I mean, almost, I guess until I met up with Dad, you know. I still have, you know, slight, like when I talk about it sometimes, you know, I guess I dreamed about it, you know, and boom, I wake up soaking it, I might wake up shouting sometimes.
Was it like an experience of a fear or a terror or horror or whatever, I don't know, just, you know, I mean, not knowing what was going to happen or...
I would say that, you know, on a lot of occasions I was scared, you know, because I really didn't want to be disabled, like, you know, lose my arm and eye and leg and stuff like that.
Could have happened at any time.
Yeah, you know, and I knew that every time a firefight would come up or something like that, you know, that it was a possibility that it would happen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I always just felt that I was going to die over there anyway, you know, because I've seen so many other guys die. And, wow, it took me, like I said, it took me a long time to really get over this, you know, because as I got through that, I didn't want to even talk to nobody about what I really experienced with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess a lot of people were the same way, too, you know. The only time they really would talk about stuff like that when they were drinking alcohol or something like that, their mind really started expressing themselves then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, just in my mom was capable of saying that.
Yeah.
And it started raining on the outside, you know, if I grab a bar of soap and run out there, start washing off and ran, something like that. Don't, you know, it's just something that, you know, that happens ordinarily, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't really go through those, you know, that many type changes, nothing like that,
mm-hmm.
you know. But
mm-hmm.
I knew that I couldn't get a job like I was supposed to. You know, I went to unemployment office day after day, day after day. And after I got back here, you know, the only resource, the only money I had was like $40-something a week from unemployment, you know what I mean? And so for a job, we're supposed to have free preference or something like that, and, which was a lie. You know, we had to wait in line just like anybody else, you know, and you still don't get no job, you don't get no benefits or nothing like that, you know, so. You know, it really made you hate the government anyway, because the way they came down.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, like in 69, I was really part of revolution as it came down, like, you know, we had the riots, San Francisco State, and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that in San Francisco. And, you know, I was just hoping that it all come down, if we got the diaspora, we're just going to die for it, you know, because it was time for these guys to get their big payback, you know. And, you know, it just left a lot of hatred in a lot of
mm-hmm.
people. I know myself is there also.
Mm-hmm. I would like you to, maybe at this point,
Yeah, well, you know, like, I went there, the first time I went to the gym, I went to the valet. I think they had one bus, blue bus or green bus, silver bus. And I went to meet out there in the valet, you know, and I've seen him, he's doing a lot of healing and stuff like that, you know. Which I really didn't understand it, he was doing it all, really didn't believe it was happening, you know. And
how did you get to come to go to Redwood Valley to see Jim Johnson? Might tell you about it?
The Blur of Town. That was, you know, my ex-comrade, Joanne's mother, auntie.
Uh-huh.
You know, she told me that, she told Joanne and I that she went to see a man named Jim Jones. She had cancer in her throat, and Jim Jones made a path of cancer to her mouth, you know. And, you know, we listened to her, and she was very serious about it and everything like that, you know. And the next day was Sunday, so she actually wanted to go with her, you know. So we went with her. And I seen him, you know, killing people and things like that, you know, which I really didn't believe it. And so I had something wrong with me also, too. I had a kidney and bladder condition. You know, that I was taking antibiotics behind because I used to take a lot of alcohol and stuff like that, you know. And I was going to doctors after doctors and stuff like that, and with the antibiotics hadn't cleared up the infection, because in my urine, it would be more like a, you know, a thick foam or something like that, so that's how bad my tissues and stuff were, you know. And, which I wasn't expecting for them, because, you know, for Dad to do nothing for me like that, because, you know, I wasn't really into it, you know, but I did. Somewhere I had a little faith that, you know, after I seen this lady who I knew, you know, something was wrong with her leg and stuff like that, you know, and start walking straight as I know. I had some faith in it, in Jim. And then, you know, I went back again. You know, I just, you know, something that happened that, you know, I every time I closed my eyes, I could see Jim. You know, I could see his face with his dog glasses on and stuff like that. You know, I knew it must have been something there, you know, that, you know, was there. And I went to a meeting at Benjamin Franklin, just getting service over there,
right,
at the high school, I mean, elementary, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And I heard my address call, you know, Jim called out my address. I didn't stand up because, you know, I thought it could have been anybody, you know. And he called out my name, you know, Robert Falls, you know, and I was surprised, you know, and I stood up. And he told me, he said, that you've been gone to many doctors, and they haven't done no good, so you didn't need name a couple of doctors and stuff like that. And, you know, it's what it got to me then, you know, and he told me I had kidney bladder condition. And at 9 something the next morning, I would have died from kidney failure, you know. And he said, it's good to be here, son, you know. He said, but he said something was that you don't know me, I always didn't know you, you know, from the day before you were born, you know, stuff like before birth, you know, stuff like that. And he said a few things about, you know, where I was from and, you know, things like that, you know. And, you know, gets good in my faith, you know. And he said, now, I'm going to take it away from you, you know. And he had his hand to me. And he said, it's still warm, which it was. And I can feel a warm, tingling sensation, you know, all around my ribs, around my stomach. And, you know, I said, yes, it is, you know. And he said, now it's cooling off, you know. And it did, you know, just like electricity went in and shook it up, whatever it was, and it just cooled off completely. You know, I didn't have no type of pain or nothing like that, you know. And he told me, say, go to, you can use the bathroom now, you know, and you urine, you see, you can go back to the doctor and check it out, you know. And ever since then, you know, I haven't had any kidney or bladder conditions, you know, which they couldn't even understand themselves, or, you know, how things just disappeared like that, you know. No,
they knew you had the condition, and then when you came back,
yeah,
it was gone. We couldn't explain it.
No, I mean, you know, what could I say, man, that, you know, this man with all this power, you know.
You couldn't tell him that.
I can say, well, you know, I'm healed, man. I'm all right, you know. And my urine, like my urine, the burn and stuff like that, the infection, everything just left. I haven't taken any antibiotics, nothing like that.
How long has it been?
Oh, wow. 72? 6 years?
Mm-hmm. And how long have you had the condition before that?
Oh, wow, months and months. I had symptoms of it, you know, when I was, right after I got out of Vietnam, you know, I got back to the States. I had symptoms of it, you know, where I had some, like, a discharge all the time, you know, which I was first went to the doctor for gonorrhea and stuff like that. That's like, there was just infections from my kidneys and stuff, you know, so it took all the different pills. And they told me it's not to drink anymore and stuff like that, you know. So I didn't listen to them after a while, and I started drinking again, you know, and it started real bad, you know, and it got so bad where, you know, I made it there, like Dad said, you're never late, you're always on time, you know, and I made it there just on time, because the next morning I was in bed, man, because I knew I was feeling so bad at night, you know, and I was undecided, you know, I said, well, maybe I should just stay here and rest, or maybe I should go, and at the last minute, you know, I made up my mind, I left, you know. I went on to meet him, that's when Dad saved my life that night, you know. And the way he did it, man, it was, wow. I mean, you know it's happened, you know what I mean? And you know he did this. Nobody else did it for you but him, you know. And, you know, I don't care what people ever say or what they do, I know he did this, you know what I'm talking about? And it just can't change my mind about it, no kind of way they tried, man. I mean, I know Dad has supernatural power, or whatever he has. His love is so heavy, you know, that he can take away whatever's necessary. I know that's bad, you know. And ever since then, I had nowhere else I want to go. No other church. I didn't believe in nothing else. Of course, you know, but Dad. And
did you find something was teaching hard? I mean, I know at one point you and companion left the movement for about a year. And I'm very glad that you're back. And I just was wondering if you want to say anything about that. And you did go back to Louisiana and stayed there for a while. Had some experiences there, I suppose.
Right. Well, you know, it really wasn't, you know, as bad as the teachers or nothing like that, you know, that I was showing rebellion toward, which, you know, it is rebellion toward dad, but, you know, it's the people that, you know, I was involved with, you know what I mean, I wanted to be with my companion and stuff like that, and they got it so that we couldn't be together, you know, mm-hmm. It wasn't dad doing it, you know, like people didn't want us together, and I felt that, you know, we wanted to be together, something we wanted to do, you know, and we just went on, you know, just kept doing it and kept getting told behind it. You know? And finally, you know, which I know I showed a lot of rebellion to dad teaching and stuff like that. I knew about a lesson, you know, when I was out, that's when everything came to me, you know. But I was hard-headed, not sure listen to dad teaching. I, you know, I wouldn't be out in this world, you know. The world was trouble anyway. I wouldn't have to go through all the stuff that I went through when I was down in Louisiana, you know. Mm-hmm. None of this teaching for me has never been hard. Just, I just didn't know how to get along with people. You know, mm-hmm.
How do you feel now?
I feel very grateful, you know. Mm-hmm. I feel this here is, you know, the most beautiful place to be in. You know, this is life, and, you know, like, you don't have to worry about getting up in the morning and, you know, you walk in front of somebody's car and they bump you off, or, you know, you don't have to worry about nobody putting up in your sleep, you know, trying to cut your throat, nothing like that, or you don't have to worry about going to jail, or you don't have to worry about going to work, you know, to make money to feed your family and nothing like that, because all it's just taken care of you, you know, we working for ourselves here, you know. And dad had made all this shit possible for us, you know, and I feel very grateful for everything that dad has done for us.
Mm-hmm. You have a man, I understand, you have a child. Yeah.
And I feel this is the best place in the world for any child to be in, you know, because the children are here now, and they never had a chance to be on drugs or alcohol or nicotine, nothing like that, and to get away from this police state and stuff like that, and that's very good. You know, I mean, that's the best thing could ever happen to a child, because their mind is free and it's clear, you know, and they don't even know nothing about all this stuff. Only thing they know is what people talk about, you know, and that's very good, because, you know, there's many, many children back in that world. It may not sound true, but it's true that, you know, it's on drugs at the age of 12, 13 years old, you know what I mean, on heavy drugs, stuff like that. And our children are so blessed because, you know, the opportunity was there, but they didn't do it. You know, they had taken away from their country before things like that came down. Mm-hmm. Because that's all that country leads you into is something like that, you know, to addicted to drugs, stuff like that. You know, to survive in the country there, you got to have some type of habits, you know. I mean, you got to have some kind of crutch to keep you going, you know, because if you just try to live naturally there, you could sustain the pressure, really. I really don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I knew that.
Yeah.
I knew when I was there, you know, even though I knew it was against the teaching and stuff like that, but I did so that I needed a crutch to keep me going. So I stayed on smoking marijuana or something like that, you know, or drinking alcohol and stuff, you know.
Do you feel like now you don't need any of that?
No, I don't need any of that at all, because, you know, when I got here, my mind is clear, man. You know, I felt a big, like something just left away from me completely, you know, that
mm-hmm.
I feel much freer, and I feel lighter, and I don't have to go through all this pressure, you know, mm-hmm. worrying about this or this and that, you know, how am I going to eat the next day, or what's going to happen tomorrow, you know, and stuff like that. I don't have to worry about that anymore. You know, what comes here, you know, what don't, you know. And I know that we always come here for the best, you know, because
mm-hmm.
Dad don't let nothing happen to any one of us here.
What do you do here? What kind of work do you do? What kind of work are you doing down
here? I'm working in the fields now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm working for the band. We, you know, we do the fields, like potatoes, beans, and we plant the beans. And, you know, we beautify the, you know, the land, stuff like that, you know, on the education. We might cut the grass along the road, stuff like that, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. How do you like your work?
It's all right, you know, it's work that I've been through before, you know, and you know, certain, you know, working for the cause, you know, and knowing that, you know, this is your land and everybody, the people's land and stuff like that, you know. You know, it's nothing that I should have to say negative about it, you know, because, you know, mm-hmm. I know I'm doing it for us, and there's more people back there that, you know, if we keep doing this, we keep it together, keep the project going like we're supposed to, we're going to have that many more people here also, you know. And, you know, I'm happy, you know, I feel I'm glad to do this here, you know, I'm very proud that I'm here, you know, because I always, you know, I say, well, whatever come down, I always want to go to the promised land. You know, I mean, I always want to go to the promised land. Now I'm in the promised land, and I want to make the best of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there's nothing else that I want to do in life but to be here with the cause. You know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because Dad is the only principle that is. He's the only truth. You know, I mean, I can listen to people day by day, and, you know, it's coming from Sam or Jai, but everything I've been hearing Dad say has been something different, you know what I mean? And it's been something that is educating us, and it's done in our health, done, you know, anything that's done in your mind is done in your health also, you know? And so, you can't beat it. No way. No way. You know, I told a lot of people about Dad, you know, about, you know, the goodness of him, and there's nothing, you know, nothing I can ever think about that would be bad about it. Everything I know is good, you know.
The tape, this is just so I can only probably type it up. Okay, excuse me. So what was that? Is it back in New Jersey you're talking about?
No, LA.
You moved to LA when you were very young?
When I was about 5 years old.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and when I was on my way to LA, right? Okay, and I was riding on the bus, and, you know, it was a long trip and whatever. And I had to use the restroom, so my mom got me off the bus and whatever. The bus driver was real nice and stuff, and he, you know, let us off the bus. And so I used the restroom and got back on, and then, you know, I made it, you know, to LA real safe. Okay, and then when I finally got there, well, then we had moved, you know, on East 48th Street. Okay, and so we was out there playing in the front yard, and okay, and then it was a funeral, and it was this policeman. He had, he was coming around the curve, and so it, he crashed into this store. Some kind of truck that carries all kinds of pastries and stuff. Mm-hmm. He crashed into the truck and knocked the truck. It tipped the truck all the way over, and which made the man's head chop off and stuff. And the police that was driving on a motorcycle going to the funeral, he died instantly. It was two of them. One died instantly, and the other motorcycle was turned upside down, and it was drilling into his body and stuff, and blood was just gushing. And so the man was driving the pastry truck, he was dead, but all his stuff and toys and stuff was all over the street. And people were going over there, you know, picking up brooms and whatever, taking it from him and stuff, and taking it to their house and, you know, whatever. And so the police and stuff started gathering around there, trying to beat the people up, trying to keep them away from, you know, getting the stuff that the man had, you know, the dead man, trying to keep them from getting it, his stuff and whatever. But they was using their billy clubs beating different people.
You were there at this time?
Uh-huh.
How old were you about?
About, I say, 6 years old.
This was in LA?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And it was a whole bunch of, you know, it was just like a mob, like, and it was, you know, beating different people and, you know, younger people and all this. And at the time, I wanted to go over there too, but, you know, my mama had told me to stay there and, you know, not to do it. Because we're still from the dead and whatever. But then I remember this time in LA, it was this race riot. It was a long time ago. And it was over at this shoe store thing called Hudson. And it, it, And so it had, they went out into a riot and it had got real bad till army trucks and stuff, jeeps and whatever, was out on the streets and they were shooting stuff, you know, shooting different people down and stuff, had big tanks and whatever. They were shooting, you know, and stuff, throwing smoke bombs and different things. And like, they had broke into the store and they was killing different people because they had broke into the store. At that time, the shoes cost about $1 and whatever. And they were stealing them and stuff, and the cops and stuff, it had surrounded the whole area and stuff with helicopters and planes and stuff like that.
What neighborhood was this?
I think it was over there in the 100s, over there near Washington, something like mm-hmm. that. And so, it just turned into a big old riot. That's what it, you know, turns out to be. And different, you know, little smoke bombs and, you know, them kind of bombs that does something to your skin. I don't know what you call them, but
napalm, maybe.
But see, it didn't. You know, it was getting everybody, but the cops and stuff, the police, they had some kind of help, some kind of equipment or something like that. You know, to protect their skin mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And like and so therefore they didn't get it, and they were spraying, you know, different some kind of gas or stuff they had. And he's spraying on different people. I mean, it just turned into a big thing. I thought it was dreaming, but we was looking out the window and stuff, out of our living room window. And it was breaking into people, you know, just banging people against the doors and burning houses and different things like that. You know, but it all started with just somebody had just these two couples, three of them, I think, took some shoes and stuff out of the store.
Mm-hmm.
And it started like that into a big old, you know, riot thing.
Mm-hmm.
Was living on 28th Street. Mm-hmm. My auntie, she had found this man, knew this man or something, that knew that, you know, went to Jim Jones Church and stuff like that. And he had told us about him and stuff like that. And so what we did, I was an atheist. I didn't even believe in God stuff. And mm-hmm. I didn't really want to go. And so my mom, me and my brother, we didn't want to go. My mom, she had begged us and stuff. And so when she finally did get us to go, it was at Cross Temple when we first started. And so when we went, he had called my mama out. And I thought it was nothing but a gag, you know. Mm-hmm. I thought he was just setting people up, paying them and stuff to do it. And so he had called my mama out. And he said that, he called her. He said, Dorothy Solomon, she stood up. And he said, do you have a son named David? Which really that's not his name, but that's the name he go by since he was in the church. And he said, yeah. And so then he said, well, he was saving his life from being killed by a semi-transferring truck, and he been saving all of us, me and my brother and my mom, from witchcraft, and that he was going to take care of the landlord because he wanted to put us out because we were 3 days late on our rent and stuff. And when we finally did pay our rent, he still wouldn't accept because we was black, and plus he was real racist and stuff, and talking about we couldn't keep our dog and, you know, stuff like that. And so he and Dad said that he's going to take care of, you know, that and for us not to even worry about it. And so he said, as long as we have a place, that we have a place in, you know, River Valley. So then that's when we started going to more meetings and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started believing in what, you know, that he really did have some kind of power or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You moved up to River Valley after a while?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
After a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, like, for one thing, it was, all you saw on the streets was, you know, dope ads and different things. Like, I knew my life was getting wasted because then I started joining gangs and stuff. Because, you know, it wasn't hardly that much stuff to do around the house. And, like, what I did, I started gang banging at the age of, when I got in the second grade. And so, I was, you know, in about three or four different gangs. And so what we did, like, in one of my games, like, I was a cripple. Okay, like, what we did, we beat up teachers and stuff like that. And, like, each of us had different weapons. Like, some of us have probably a gun or a knife. Some have chains and different things like that. And then we have this double-intensive dog, too, trained to, you know, kill on the spot or something like that. And, like, what we did, like, if we didn't like what they was doing, you know, different people would do to us, like, the teachers and stuff, or we just pick on people for no reason, and we beat on them and stuff like that. And
even
like,
in the second grade, you got people packing guns and chains and stuff?
Yeah. And like, because okay, like all it was like reputation. I mean, you know, looking, you know, see who's big and all bad and all this stuff. And like the way I started in it was, you know, my cousins had started me in. But see, I acted like a, you know, a little tomboy and stuff, and they thought it was all stupid for that I was acting like that and stuff. And so they put me in the game. So what they, you know, I was, you know, helping beat up people, and like my teacher had told me to go sit down or something. And I called her some kind of, I can't even remember what name it was. And so she pushed me. And my, you know, I had a whole bunch of kids that was in my gang. And, you know, they used to hang around my class and stuff for checking. And so she pushed me. And then one of my partners came in, you know, whatever they were. He came in and shot her in the neck. And then I went over there and I kissed him. You know, see, I was, you know, I was just mean.
You shot her in the neck with a gun?
Yeah.
And how old grade was this?
Second, when I was in the second.
How old was your partner who shot her?
He's about 10, I think, 10 mm-hmm. or 11, something like that. Okay, and so they shot her in the neck, and I went over there and started beating her and still. And so they suspended me for a while. And then I, and so the principal that suspended me, we got him too at the end, you know, when, okay, like when it was time for us to graduate and stuff, we went and got him again and stuff like that. Like, some of my part, the people that I was hanging around with, they went, you know, they go, you know, went to his house and threw rocks and broke his windows and stuff, and planted a smoke bomb and stuff, you know, different things, and beat up his children real bad, you know, and
he's a white guy?
Yeah, and see, he was real, real prejudiced. That's what made it even worse. Like, he'd be saying, "Come here, nigga." He would call us our names and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's what really set all the
time. What school was this
at? At Nevin Avenue in L.A.
And there was no black school?